Today's program is brought to you by Nettle Meadow Farm Cheese and Spirits Pairing, taking place on Saturday, June 18th at Nettle Meadow Farm. For more information, visit NettleMeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com. That's N-E-T-T-L-E, MeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Cynthia Cherish Malloran, Reverend DJ Cherish the Love, and you are listening to Primary Food on Heritage Radio Network. Hey, so before I forget, let me tell you how to reach out to me and get my attention on social media, Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at DJ Cherish the Love, and that is spelled love, L-U-V. Hashtag using Primary Food, Heritage underscore radio, and hashtag Rev Love. So welcome to the sixth episode of the second season of Primary Food. I don't know how in the blink of an eye I've done 18 episodes, but I'm feeling super happy and emotional about it because it's the last one with my dear friend Jack Inslee in the booth staring at me. Aww. Making faces. And he's going on tour with Odetta. I love you guys, and I wish you all the best and most awesome adventures. I miss you already.
Thanks, Cynthia. You rule.
Aww. So what exactly is primary food? I learned this really great concept in nutrition school at IIN, the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, that the food you eat, you know, the stuff that my guest is putting in his mouth right now, pizza from Roberta's.
Oh, my God.
The stuff we chew and enjoy, we consider that secondary food. Primary food is everything else in life that nourishes us before we sit down to eat. And that's stuff like enjoying music, reading a book, hanging out with friends, cooking food, a great job, creative expression, playing games, playing with babies, exercise. And I'm so glad that I learned this because it was the high quality primary food that I kept in my life while going through chemotherapy last year that kept me happy and healing my cancer. So you can call in live, 718-497-2128, and I'll give that number again because I'm sure there wasn't a pen in your hand, 718-497-2128. So today's primary food focus is creative expression and storytelling. And today we are continuing the DMC Deep Meaningful Conversations with, coincidentally, the editor-in-chief of DMC Comics, Edgardo Miranda Rodriguez, working with Daryl McDaniels of DMC. There's a lot of DMC in my last 10 seconds of life, right? So Daryl McDaniels is out of town, so he's not with us, but I'll get him in here. And Edgardo is the owner of Somos Arte and also a writer at Marvel Comics. And hey there, want to say hello into the mic for us? He's still swallowing food.
Hola. Still swallowing the pizza.
And joining
What's up, Brooklyn?
Yes.
Bushwick in the house. Williamsburg, stand up. Bed-Stuy, do or die, stand up. Sunset Park in the house. Coney Island, what's up? Marlboro Projects, represent, you know, all over planet Brooklyn.
Planet, you know, Brooklyn, I love it. I love it.
Ya tú sabes, representing for all my peoples in Brooklyn.
He's
and
excited.
And everyone all over Nueva York. And everyone within the pixels of this broadcast, you know, enjoy the show.
I enjoy
this pizza.
I love it. Joining us is Edgardo's wife, Kyung Jun.
Hi, this is Kyung.
Hi, and she's also an amazing artist and storyteller.
Thank you.
And also with us is their itty-bitty 10-month.
10-minute.
10-month. 10-month-old
Sorry for
son.
The mess. Somebody get a mop.
10-month-old son and Yo. Okay, hey, 10 months.
We're keeping him quiet right now because he's breastfeeding.
Well, that's great because this is a, you know,
primary food.
This is a food show. So he's having his dinner.
He's having his dinner.
And let's talk about that. So that's his dinner. Let's talk about secondary food for a minute. So what is food culture like at home with you guys, with your ethnic backgrounds?
It's a mix. It's a hybrid. We try to bring a little bit of our backgrounds into our cuisine, into our enjoyment of food. I think one of my favorite dishes that we actually put together in the years that we've been together is actually taking some kimchi and putting it on top of pasteles.
Ooh.
Pasteles are these kind of like dishes that are made in Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Dominican Republic. They're it's kind of like, it looks like a tamale, but it's made with plantains and it's baked, it's boiled inside of a banana leaf. Mm. So it's just a lot of deliciousness made with a lot of vegetables and some meats and spices and such. But then when we kind of like put it on top with some kimchi, it was just like this Corican experience.
Corican.
That is just mind blowing. That's what Ennio is. Ennio is a Coricua, a Korean Boricua, you know?
And he's saying something.
Yeah,
he agrees.
His hands on the microphone.
It's adorable.
About that.
And one of the things we do since in our home, since Kyung does most of the primary caregiving for Ennio, with the nursing and a lot of his primary care and education and developmental activities that she engages him with, I do all the cooking. I do breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Yeah, so Kyung has been pushing me to cook. She's an amazing cook herself. And it's challenged me to kind of like pull a lot of my traditional cuisines from my background, from my family, from Puerto Rico. So I do a lot of like stewed dishes, like pollo guisado or codfish or bacalao. And stuff like that, and mofongo, you know. I've also even tried making my own version of like sancocho, but with like chicken instead of beef.
What is mofongo? That's like a mofongo, great word.
Mofongo is a dope word. Oh my god!
It sounds like a curse.
No, it's not a curse. It's a blessing. Mofongo is a blessing. So mofongo pretty much is like you take the mortar and pestle, right? Usually associated with like apothecaries or pharmacists. But a mortar and pestle in Puerto Rico, they're made of wood. And so you take the mortar and pestle, and oftentimes they could be as big as a small pot. And you mash up fried plantains inside the mortar and pestle, along with some kind of like freshly fried and sauteed garlic. And depending on what your personal preference is, you could actually put in some like fried pork rinds or fried shrimp or fried chicken or fried fish.
And he loves that.
Oh, yes, he does. And then you kind of mash it up inside, and it kind of like forms a bit of a little in the shape of the actual mortar, and it, when you pop it out, it literally looks like a dome. You put it on the dish, and then on top of that, you put actually like a stewed dish. So you could put a stewed beef dish or a stewed chicken dish or a stewed fish dish. And it's like really popular in Puerto Rico. When we go to the small town in Puerto Rico called Santurce, our favorite restaurant is called Molini's. And they have like the best mofongo there. And the dude that runs the spot is actually from the Bronx. So
he's down there. That's amazing.
Yes, he's down there, and his stuff is like really authentic. It's a trip, and the stuff is delicious. So, and that's what mofongo is. Mofongo is mashed up plantains and with any other kind of like saucy meat that you want to add to it.
So, in case someone hasn't experienced a plantain, explain the difference between a sweet banana and a plantain.
Well, the plantain, for example, these are tropical fruits, mostly found in the Caribbean and even parts of Asia. The plantain is a type of banana. They're technically a lot larger. Sometimes you can find a plantain as large as like 12 inches and such. And depending on how you prepare it, it's two styles of preparing it. You can actually take a ripe plantain and when it's actually yellow, and then actually simply fry the plantains as is. And it's a great side dish, the sweet plantains. But if you actually take the plantains when they're green, you can do so much more. You can actually fry them. It's kind of like Puerto Rican French fries in a way, because they're not sweet. They're actually like a little bland.
That's my favorite.
Yes, okay. That's Kyung's favorite. You know,
fried anything or just specifically that?
That's specifically tostones.
Tostones, yes. So when you fry them, they're tostones. But the thing about the plantain, when it's green, you can do a lot of stuff. You could grind it up, and it's part of the base to make pasteles. You could grind it up, and you can actually mix it in with other foods, or you could actually mash it up into what is mofongo. So there's a lot more kind of like usage you could get out of the green plantain. But then again, you know, there's a lot of like really great recipes for sweet plantains. Like there's this really great recipe where you take the sweet plantain whole, the actual whole banana, and you actually slice it down the middle, bake it, and then you actually bake it with like ground meat in the middle of it. Uh-huh. And that itself is kind of like a dish, a stuffed plantain and stuff. So those are the...
That's a meat and potatoes amazing. Kind of a situation.
Yeah, it's really hearty. But the thing is like, one of the things I learned from my cousin Lillian, she taught me when I was younger and I was a vegetarian. Not anymore. But when I was a vegetarian, she always taught me to... Not eliminate everything from my diet. And I was like some of this like hardcore vegetarian. I didn't even like anything that was like sauteed or fried. She was like, Nene, you gotta at least have plantains because they're so rich in potassium. It's not like potatoes. You get so much more from plantains. And that's what I do. And so instead of like frying like, you know, potatoes, I fry plantains. And we use it as a side dish all the time. And both of my sons, both Kian and Ennio, they love it. You know, Ennio is 10 months old, but he throws down, yo. He throws down. He loves to eat grown-up food. Oh, my God. He loves to eat. I mean, he's only 10 months old, and he's standing upright like he's a two-year-old
kid.
Yeah,
he's been walking around the studio. I thought he was two.
Yeah, he's no joke. He is definitely no joke. He is in the house.
So let's talk about the co part in the Coricua.
So that's my partner, Kyung. She's actually an amazing artist and stuff. This is actually great that we're here because I wanted her to talk about her art and her own health. Because even having and physically having Ennio here is a miracle because Kyung actually has had endometriosis for the last 20 years. So I think she should talk a little bit more about that herself.
Was it 20 years? I think it's 16 years.
Is it 16?
Yeah, 16. Diagnosed when I was 24. I'm 40 now, so yeah. But health is really a big part of like diet and everything. It's really a big part of staying on top of the endometriosis, the inflammation, things like that. You have today, obviously, I'm cheating by having some gluten, but just trying to stay gluten free, sugar free, things like that is really important.
See, he doesn't like gluten either.
He doesn't like gluten. It's a trip. That's actually true. Ken, we got to talk closer to the mic.
So tell us about your discovery of how food affected that.
I noticed it helps with digestion. Digestion is a big part of the endometriosis pain. Mm-hmm. It's sort of hand in hand. As the endometriosis grows more severe, it helps. It affects everything from your, you know, reproductive organs to your digestive system, and even some people have it, you know, all the way in. Up going to their lungs and their brain, it can go affect every organ.
Oh, wow.
So for me, I'm trying to stay on an endo diet, which helps as much as I can.
I had never heard of that before, an endo diet.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's basically gluten-free, sugar-free,
yes.
Dairy-free?
Dairy-free, they're it's pretty much trying to eat healthy, no fried foods, no spicy. I try as best as I can. I've been cheating a lot, but yeah, we try as best as we can with a baby.
And when you discovered that, is that when you were able to conceive in you, or how did that...
Well, we actually didn't think that we were going to be able to conceive. We didn't know that we were able to. I had an operation. It's a laparoscopy, and it was my third operation for endometriosis to remove. It was a deep excision surgery, and it's to remove all the endometriosis, which is basically the lining of the endometrium comes out through the... through the ovary, and then it attaches itself to different organs and areas in the pelvic area. Uh-huh. And every month, for some women, it happens almost every day. It's inflammation, and it still thinks it's in your uterus. And so when you have your period, it's inflammation.
I see.
And it's very, very painful. It affects one in every 10 women. Diet, trying to, you know, de-stress, things like that. Go to therapy, things like that help as best as you can.
Is your Korean food cultural background helpful for this? Because there isn't much dairy in there, right?
is there? There's no gluten.
There really is. The thing about Korean food, yeah, it naturally doesn't have like gluten in it. I mean, it's not a noodle heavy or bread heavy cuisine to begin with. You know,
we do a lot of stir fries at home with vegetables. We throw kimchi in it. Kimchi is really good for the digestion, but spicy makes it a little bit rough. But I still eat it anyways.
Now, you're also a creative person.
Yes.
So talk about your project for a second. What are you working on right now?
Well, right now, as best as I can, I try to paint whenever he's napping. I call it the nap time series. So whenever he's napping or sleeping, I try to work on some paintings. And they're all paintings inspired. Well, my work is really inspired by him these days. It's motherhood. Motherhood has always been a topic in my work ever since I was 24. It's because, and when I was 24, it came into my work. It sort of, came into the work because I thought I wasn't able to ever have a child. That's what the doctor said. Because of the endometriosis being severe, I didn't think I was going to ever have a child. So the topics of motherhood and breastfeeding and things like that always came into the work in a weird way. And it was very, very, I think, sad. Hmm. It was very, very, I'm not sure how to describe it, but there's a lot of, like, sadness in the work because I wanted obviously to have children, but I wasn't sure if I was going to because the doctors told me I wouldn't. So the work has been very autobiographical with very fantastical twist into them.
Uh-huh.
And now with him in my life, it's just been about my connection with him and literally drawings of him and
that's incredible. I mean, the pinnacle of creativity is creating a human being, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, I say that he's my biggest art project.
He's your finest work ever.
Exactly. Really.
And where can people see your work?
My website is kyung.com, kyung.com.
And what medium do you work with?
I work with rice paper. It's called a hanji paper. Uh-huh. It's what people use in Korea to practice calligraphy.
Okay.
And so I use that and watercolor pencil and gouache. So it's very sort of delicate touch on top of the rice paper.
Check out her work again. And the website again is?
Kyung.com, KYUNG.com.
Now let's talk about Korean food for a second.
Mm.
Okay, what do you call those little dishes that they put on the table?
Banchan.
Okay, could you describe those for me? Because that's heaven to me.
Yeah.
The nonstop little dishes that keep coming in.
Like, yeah, oh. They're free too. You typically, a good
that's
restaurant
the best part,
would be free.
They're free. So what, off of the top of your head, what are they?
So a good restaurant would have maybe one or two different kinds of kimchi. It's like a radish kimchi. It's called gakdugi, or just a kimchi, which has like it's from the leaf, the Napa cabbage. The leafy kind, that's just standard kimchi.
Which is the kimchi that someone had told me is called the bachelor kimchi?
Bachelor? I don't know what that is.
Okay, I'm going to have to look that up because I might be totally making that up.
No, I don't know that one.
And kimchi is made out of what exactly? I've never known this.
Kimchi is the Napa cabbage. And, you'll see, if you see, look it up, you'll see like, older women sitting on the ground with big steel, metal like bowls, uh-huh. And they're like mat with like plastic gloves on, and they're mashing on this like kind of red pepper concoction that they've put together with garlic and salt, pepper, and a lot of red pepper, and they're mashing it in between all the leaves of the cabbage, and then that's you put that in a jar,
uh-huh.
And you pickle it.
And you just let it sit and ferment, basically.
Yes. Yeah. the longer you ferment it, the stronger the
everything.
The everything.
The stronger the everything. The smell, the taste, the nutritional benefits,
exactly.
Everything.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got the kimchi banchan, right?
Yeah.
And then next to it is?
Then you have things like, you have maybe like a cucumber, little cucumber that's been sautéed in sesame oil and has sesame seeds, or some mung bean sprouts, you know, those bean sprouts, and they have you know, also sautéed in like sesame oil, and those are served cold or room temperature. You'll have maybe a fish. If it's a really good restaurant, they'll give you like a small little mackerel that's been sort of pan fried
for free.
Yeah. And I'll just like, you know, different assortments of, you know, maybe you'll have a potato salad, a Korean style with like apples in it, or you'll have little different mushrooms. I don't know, different kinds of.
Is there a meaning behind each one, or is it just tradition?
I don't know what the meaning is. Actually, we've grown up having them all of our lives, just having it accompany the food. A lot of times we eat it as an appetizer, you know. They give it to you in a restaurant as an appetizer, but you're supposed to actually eat it with the meal. It's to sort of accompany the meal.
Every time I eat at a Korean restaurant, I am stuffed
after the banchan.
Stuffed. But it's so good, and I always go with friends, so it's a great primary food, you know, situation when you're hanging out with friends and enjoying the food, and then you're eating secondary food.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a little break, and then we'll talk about more creativity.
Okay, great.
Cheese and Spirits Pairing is a celebration of good food and beverages in the newly restored Barn Loft event venue at Nettle Meadow Farm in Thurman, New York. On Saturday, June 18th, come sample and savor, then buy your favorite cheeses and beverages to take home. Nettle Meadow cheeses have been praised highly in national media and have won prestigious awards from the American Cheese Society. Taste samples of goat and sheep cheeses paired with an array of local regional wines, beers, and ciders. You'll never forget your first sample of rich, creamy Kunik, Nettle Meadow's trademark cheese. In Esquire, our very own Anne Saxelby said, "Kunik, it may very well be the sexiest cheese in the USA." Nettle Meadow Farm is a goat and sheep dairy and cheese company in Thurman, New York, just below Crane Mountain in the Adirondacks, between Gore Mountain, North Creek, and Warrensburg. It's owned and operated by Lorraine Limbiase and Sheila Flanagan. Both have a great love of animals, artisan cheese, and the unique challenges of farm life. Nettle Meadow Farm was originally founded in 1990, and it's the home of over 300 goats, dozens of sheep, and a variety of farm sanctuary animals. Again, the cheese and spirits pairing is Saturday, June 18th. For more information and tickets, visit NettleMeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com. That's N-E-T-T-L-E, MeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com.
Edgardo, what is the most delicious thing you've eaten recently?
Well, and about 20 minutes ago, I had some pasta with with some clams here, Roberta's. And then we had this amazing watermelon salad that had like a pureed avocado and black lime.
Hello.
My gosh, that was decadent, man. Oh my goodness. We went to Fetisal for Memorial Day because we were like, yo, we live in Winnersburg. And we were like, yo, everybody has like barbecues. Everybody has backyards. We're in Brooklyn. And then we're like, well, hold on. We're in Brooklyn. And we live like right around the corner for Fetisal. We walked right over. It was like, yo, there was no line. And we got in there. We got like the brisket. We got the barbecue chicken. Oh my gosh, we threw down like we were we were carnivores, yeah. But we threw down like we were like cavemen. That was amazing.
I think it's voted Time Out's like number one barbecue place in New York City.
Oh,
and
wow.
We live like a block and a half away from them. We never knew.
And you never knew.
We never knew.
We thought it was just now some French place.
We did. They, oh, French. They cook everything with dairy and the cream.
Lactose intolerant.
Yeah, you can't mess with that. Lactose intolerant.
So what is the most nourishing thing you guys have done for yourselves lately? So I like to discern the difference between eating and the nourishment.
Well, I think the most nourishing thing that we do for ourselves, aside from actually like consuming good food, is quality time. You know, we try to give ourselves a good hour a day to go for a walk, and we like to start our day.
That's great.
Doing that, we go to the park in our neighborhood and we walk for a good hour. Depending on how warm it is, we might actually put the baby on the swing for a while. But it's like really cathartic, because we kind of like, it isn't so much like, oh, what are we going to do today? It's more like just an opportunity to have a conversation and kind of like talk about things and just wax poetic and actually have an opportunity to be around each other, unplugged, disconnected. You know, unfortunately, every now and then I get phone calls and stuff like that, but I try to do my best to kind of like stay unplugged so that we could do that. And I think that's probably one of the best things that we do to nourish ourselves, is try to at least give ourselves an hour to hang out. And then on top of that, we try to do all of our meals together, our dinner, our breakfast, and our lunch. We literally try to do that all the time for each other. So in the morning, I'll cook breakfast, or we'll go out for lunch, and I'll cook dinner, and we'll try to literally do that. And you know, we don't have the TV on. There's no radio on. It's just literally our faces, and we're engaging with each other.
And why do you find that so important?
It's important because we live in an age where everything, we're bombarded with media, we're bombarded with content constantly, and we are living content. So we actually have to enjoy each other's presence and actually learn and how to grow with that. And I think as a father of two boys, I think it's important to do that. I mean, Ennio is 10 months old. My oldest son, Kian, is 12, and he's autistic. So it's important that we actually engage him and create a culture that really introduces quality dialogue and actual time with each other, and not necessarily anything that will feed a story to us, like a TV show while we're eating, or the radio blasting while we're eating. You know, it's just like,
that's beautiful.
It's just just having a, and we literally sit down facing each other, and we engage, and we have our seats at the table, and we just engage with each other. And even Ennio, we put him on the high chair, and we'll give him his food while we're eating, or give him something right off our dishes.
And that is a perfect example of primary food right there. The nourishing stuff before you eat, or while you eat.
And even like when we're like together, if we're going on a trip driving, we try to talk as often as we can to each other and not actually have the radio on. And we'll maybe have like classical music in the background so that we won't get distracted. I mean, we throw down with some songs. I ain't trying to be no old dude listening to NPR only, you know what I mean? But we actually do take some time to engage with each other, and I think it's important. And then it's important to have some me time. When we have the chance, we'll give each other a break. And Kyung's me time is literally her in front of her canvas, painting or sketching. My me time may be finally, you know, reading some comic books, or maybe we'll have some we time, and we'll all kind of like curl around the TV and watch some Miyazaki. We have an entire box set of Miyazaki, and we love his films, because they're such non-traditional stories. Even though a lot of them are based on original Western stories, his reinterpretation of these tales are so beautiful, and it's important to show that, because there's a balance. My older son, Kian, is really into like a lot of the superhero films and such, as am I. But I think it's nice to introduce something as an alternative. And even when you actually hear Kian say, "I like this. It's so different in terms of the ending. The bad guys actually weren't that bad after all. They actually worked together and found a solution." I mean, that's some revolutionary stuff right there, you know. So to actually have that opportunity to get that from
a
film.
That's a great point. I think that basically you're telling me storytelling is super important. And what is the importance of storytelling for you as a writer for Marvel Comics, as an editor-in-chief?
I mean, I look at it as, like, I'm Puerto Rican, so I'm a hybrid of different races. The Taínos, which were the original inhabitants of the island, the Africans that came to the Caribbean as slaves, the Spaniards that colonized and kind of brought us all together. And it's a mixture of all of that. A lot of our traditional stories from our Taíno heritage or our African traditions were through oral tradition, through storytelling. That's the only thing that kept us empowered. That's the only thing that kept us grounded. That's the only thing that connected us to our history. We didn't actually have print. Mm-hmm. You know, the first thing you do when you colonize and you take over a nation is you get rid of their archives, you get rid of their history. You literally burn the books, you literally storm the libraries, you know. But you can't destroy the imagination, and you can't destroy these stories that are part of our legacy, that are part of our DNA. And so when you look at these, when you hear these stories, you begin to understand how important it is to tell stories. And I do that with my sons. You know, I make up stories for Ennio, or I engage Kian to write his own stories. And Kian actually looks at his room as his studio. Like, he'll literally sit at his desk and he'll write himself some stories, short stories, create new characters. And I think that's kind of like the best way to do it. I think Kyung was kind of like blown away when, in the last few years, I started getting into doing comic books, because she was like, where are these stories coming from? Hmm. And then I'll tell her, they've always been inside of me. These stories have always been here. I just haven't had the opportunity to literally put, you know, fingertips to keyboards or actually, like, have these stories come out.
That's incredible.
You know, and so in terms of, like, storytelling is powerful. But even more powerful when the stories reflect a reality that is oftentimes overlooked. When the stories reflect a community of people who are not represented. And oftentimes people in the regular entertainment industry, they like to refer to this kind of conversation as diversity, you know, or hashtag Oscars so white. But when you're a person of color, it's not about it's not a trending topic. When you're a person of color, it's called survival. It's imperative that we actually have control and create our own narratives. My mentor, who was an original member of the Young Lords Party, Iris Morales, used to always tell me, if we don't tell our own stories, no one else will. And that has been a part of my life for decades now. And that's why I tell the stories I do. So when I tell stories, they come from a place of responsibility and accountability, because I can't afford to just tell stories for the sake of storytelling. And you know what? There's a lot of amazing storytellers out there that create completely fantastical worlds, and that's dope. You know what I'm saying? My stories have a little bit of fantasy rooted in them, but they also have a strong sense of familiarity. When I direct these stories for Daryl Makes Comics, I create an era of New York City that is oftentimes forgotten, the 1980s. And in terms of what that era looked like before hip-hop became pop music, before hip-hop was only like... before rap was extracted from hip-hop culture. And you can't put rap in a comic book, but you could put graffiti, you could put style, you could put vernacular. And that's what we do with Daryl Makes Comics. And when we wrote our first book for Marvel Comics, that's also what we did. We introduced our vernacular into these stories, but at the same time, we introduced our neighborhood. And, for example, The Thing is an original member of the Fantastic Four, and he was created by Jack Kirby and Stan Lee, and Jack Kirby kind of used The Thing as kind of like a reflection of his own childhood and his own life. He grew up in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, but Jack Kirby grew up in the 1930s, possibly even the 20s of the Lower East Side. And Lower East Side hasn't been that neighborhood in decades. In fact, for the last 30 to 40 years, it's been predominantly Puerto Rican Latino, you know, with such cultural institutions like the New Rican Poets Cafe, Clemente Sotovelas Cultural Center, Lower East Side Festival, you know. So when we had the chance to do something for Marvel, Darryl focused his side of the story on The Thing's look and vernacular. And I created the rest of the world. And it wasn't even like I created the Lower East Side for Marvel. I just kind of like took the camera lens and pointed it exactly at where it was.
And
Marvel never really created a comic book that actually ever had public housing in it. And I said, look, this comic book is literally going to show the Jacob Riis public housing. Because one thing that people often forget about or neglect to acknowledge about the Lower East Side of Manhattan is that it's quite possibly the longest stretch of public housing in New York City. Now, there are complexes here in Brooklyn that are very large in terms of densely populated. But when you talk about the actual square footage and the actual length, I mean, Lower East Side housing projects start at 12th or 13th Street in Manhattan, and they go down past Houston. So that's easily almost a mile of public housing that literally covers the east side of Manhattan.
Is this also where La Borinquena comes from?
Well, La Borinquena actually comes from Williamsburg. Okay. But just to wrap up on that, when I created the stuff for that story for Marvel, I wanted to show a side of New York City that people forget about. And it's a poor working class experience. So when the Thing comes to visit his old neighborhood, he's interacting with a diverse community, mostly of people of color, mostly of poor working class folk. And the character that I introduced is actually the one that ended up becoming very popular from that series, was a Afro-Boricua grandmother, which literally translates, for those who don't understand, is a dark-skinned Latina. Like, if you don't know, the Latino community is an entire spectrum. We literally have people that look as dark as Wesley Snipes and as white as Cameron Diaz. And that's just all within our family. You don't even have to go outside of our family. Now, when I created La Borinquena, she actually is from the south side of Williamsburg. I've been living in Brooklyn for half my life. I'm 45. I'll be 46 this month. 23 years of my life, I've literally been living in Brooklyn since 1993. So when I created when I had the chance to create something original, again, it's going back to that conversation of storytelling. So when you're creating stories, you listen to the stories that are already around you. You listen to the stories that people are sharing, oral tradition. So I've lived in Williamsburg for like the last 23 years, and I was a youth organizer and activist. And there are many stories I've heard from other young people, from families, from activists. And so I think La Borinquena for me really speaks to that part of Williamsburg, because everybody is like, you know, talks about Fetisau and all these amazing restaurants and all the condos coming up. But it's already been a community that's been there for decades and has struggled to leave its mark and has struggled to say presente, which is Spanish for we are here.
Now, this character is a female superhero.
Yes, she is.
That is so hardcore. You inspired me when you introduced that to me.
Well, I wanted to create a character. I was back in March, I decided I wanted to be bold. Because I've been in the graphic novel industry now for like the comic book industry now professionally for the last 3 to 4 years. And, you know, I'm not getting any younger. So I'm just being a lot more aggressive and faster with my ideas. And in March, I decided to pitch an idea to the Puerto Rican Day Parade. They reached out to me because they wanted me to do something with them when they heard about the stuff I did with Marvel. And so I said, well, what if we created a whole new superhero and a whole new comic book?
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to be bold because I wanted to create something that was 100% mine, 100% my copyright, my trademark. And so I officially licensed it to the parade. And La Borinquena is actually the first superhero ever officially endorsed by the Puerto Rican Day Parade. And it's 59 years. And she's being used right now, literally, as a symbol to raise awareness, to raise funds for their scholarship fund. They've already given out 14 scholarships this year.
Incredible.
You know, and this is just something that literally just launched 3 weeks ago, and it's gone viral.
You must be so proud. That's amazing.
I don't know if I'm proud or overwhelmed, because it's kind of like I never expected it to get the kind of buzz, and it's gotten buzz all across the United States to Puerto Rico. And the other reason why I created the character is because I wanted to use her as a platform to really discuss the debt crisis in Puerto Rico. Because when you talk about like primary foods, you know, you have to really look at your home also, because that's what nourishes you.
Exactly.
And when your home is in jeopardy of being taken from you, and when your home has been taken from you, or your career, or your schools, or your institutions, which is exactly what's happening in Puerto Rico with hospitals closing, schools shutting down, the government literally on the brink of collapsing because of this incredible $73 billion debt that has ballooned over the last few years. I thought it was important to create a character that would kind of give me the opportunity to express how what I felt about it, but also kind of take these really complex ideas of what's going on with the Puerto Rican economy and break it down in a way that would be easily digestible, like Panchan.
I love that. Now, how do I make a superhero character, a food superhero character?
You don't have to. You are a superhero. What are you talking about, girl? You are a superhero. If you're listening to this show and you don't know who Cynthia is yet, you're smoking crack. You are a superhero because you are a survivor. You don't need superpowers. And I think that's what's amazing about you. And I've been, you know, we've known each other for a couple of years, and I follow you on social media. And it's inspiring to see how your life is literally a beacon for positivity, and it's literally a symbol of power. And I think that, you know, oftentimes when you look at the whole superhero genre, people get caught up in a fantasy but neglect to realize that real heroes walk amongst us, like yourself, you know. And when you recognize the realness that's inside of you, that is actually what is, in essence, your actual superpower. For me, my superpower was my Puerto Ricanness. For you, your superpower was the ability to overcome this cancer and say, you know what? Cancer doesn't define me. I define it, and its definition is finite. And that's what you did, you know?
I'm holding back tears. That definitely wasn't the answer I was expecting, but that really landed in me, Edgardo, that kind
well,
of...
you're a warrior, you know what I mean? And, you know, cancer hits me personally at home. I've lost many family members to cancer, and it's crazy. You know, it's crazy. My youngest cousin was only 19 when she died of cancer, and she thought she beat it, and it came back with a vengeance. And unfortunately, she wasn't strong enough, you know. But I think it's imperative to celebrate the lives of those around us when they do overcome something like cancer, or in the case of my wife, endometriosis. You know, for 16 years, the doctors told her, just get it out of your head. You are never going to have children. Mm. Just get that. And to tell that to a woman is crazy, you know, because it's like it's a woman's choice whether they should have a child or not. But when somebody's telling you, you have no choice anymore. And some women take the decision and say, you know what, I'm just going to push with my career. I'm cool if I don't have children. But when you tell someone, it doesn't matter what you want, because you can't have it anyway. And when that's part of your life, you know, it defines you to an extent, but then you have to kind of like get that power back and redefine yourself. And when you redefine yourself, you realize that you actually have the power, which is the case with you. Cancer could have been the end of your story, the end of your sentence. And you chose to just make it part of the sentence and just turn the page and your story continues.
I love you for saying that, because sometimes I sit and I think that I made it the start of my sentence.
It's just your story continues. You're here now. You're moving your narrative forward. You're moving your work forward and facilitating these conversations, this being your 18th one. And you're only going to continue to do great work, because one of the things you realize in embracing your superpower, your own hero, is that you actually can determine what your life is going to be. And you've literally overcome this. And everything you do from here on has that much more significance. And that's just the reality. That's just your reality. And it's a reality now that many other people will share, because you're a living symbol of hope, and you are a living symbol of power. So you are a superhero. You don't need anybody to give you a cape. You already got a cape.
Wow. What a way. I mean, with a minute left, I don't even know what to say, honestly, because, I am really at a loss for words for what you just said to me. And
you'll be good. You'll be good next show. You'll be good. You'll be good.
Please, Edgardo, tell us where we can all check out your work.
Oh, cool. Just, on my website, it's Somos Arte. That's Spanish for We Are Art. So SomosArte.com, or you can follow me on social media. My Twitter is at Mr. Edgardo NYC. And I'm also on Instagram with the same handle. And everything I'm doing, literally, like, it's at this, you know, at the edge of my seat. Everything is like literally happening. You know, you reached out to me a couple of days ago to do this show. I just did a New York Times interview, a Washington Post interview just a few weeks ago. It's blowing me away that this little character that I created to raise awareness about the debt crisis in Puerto Rico is resonating with people beyond this small little island of 3.5 million people.
And it's no surprise to me that anything you create is going to go that far.
Thank you.
Oh my God, that's the end of this show. And, you know, thank you everyone who's been listening. I'm really like super emotional right now, so we're just going to wrap up. This has been Cynthia Cherish Mallory, and you've been listening to Primary Food and Heritage Radio Network.
What?
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.